I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, the do-it-yourself medical movement in the ALS community. Patients brewing their own drugs, sharing information online. We'll have that story. But first, let's check in Chicago, where the streets are quiet after yesterday's brief flare-up between protesters and police. Still, commuters in Chicago faced extra security and closed train stations today as world leaders met for the second and final day of the NATO summit. Some downtown businesses told their employees to stay home. There was no coffee. During the morning commute, food and liquids had been banned from public transportation. But then President Obama opened today's session at the summit, saying that he expects Afghan forces will be ready to take over the country's defenses in 2013. That will relegate U.S. and NATO troops to a supporting role a full year ahead of schedule. Rick Pearson is chief political writer for the Chicago Tribune. Rick, put the president's statement in context. Was that a big surprise announcement a year ahead?
I think it really was. I think everybody was still focused on the 2014 agreed-upon date. And, I mean, I think this is more maybe perhaps a motivational thing than maybe a practical one in really having the Afghan forces ready to take that lead role for the entire country.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're reading a book by Fawaz Jurjiz, the Mideast commentator that's going to be coming up down the line. And in that book, I noted this weekend, he said that officials told him off the record that they had said to Afghan leaders that NATO or U.S. forces, that somebody was going to be there forever. So, you know, the question is NATO on board with that year earlier declaration?
I think that is still something that needs to be worked out. I mean, you know, when you look at the fact of the post-2014 time frame that had been laid out, you have these questions about the support from the NATO communities, $4.1 billion a year. I mean, we're just coming out of a G8 summit in Camp David where the focus was on the issues of trying to do economic growth in times of austerity. And yet when the NATO countries are being asked for $4.1 billion in annual support to Afghanistan, I mean, these are some very technical issues that need to be worked out.
Well, the money issue was very much on the mind, it would seem, of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who thanked American taxpayers this weekend, said his country looked forward to the day when it was no longer a burden. But as you said, that's not in the near future financially. And then you have the Pakistani president, Asif Ali Zardari. He's in Chicago, but sort of in this kind of hapless way, the president has refused to meet with him. And this has to do with supply routes. Just tell us what the issue is there.
Well, Zardari was invited to the NATO summit, and it was very interesting in the opening of today's meeting where Obama thanked countries to Afghanistan's north that have permitted expanded shipments of war supplies since Pakistan had closed off the ground route 6 months ago. I mean, this was really Obama had expectations that this issue was going to be resolved, and he comes to his hometown of Chicago and basically finds that Pakistan wants an increased monetary reward for allowing these shipments to take place. And, you know, in some respects, it looks like the president is president of the United States is trying to be shaken down by Pakistan. So it's very much that Zardari finds himself kind of in isolation sitting at that big round table that everyone's at.
Well, meanwhile, just one last thought in the minute we have, Rick Pearson. We saw the flare-up of violence between protesters outside the summit and Chicago police, but you and others are saying that Chicago police had tried to take a different tact at this meeting.
Very much so. As a result of protests at other sites, most notably in Seattle, in 1999, Chicago police adopting not a tactic of mass arrest, but really trying to isolate those that are considered troublemakers, not infuriate a big crowd. So far, we've got reports of about 60 arrests. Yeah, there were some flare-ups yesterday, but also helping, I think, to keep things down was the fact that the protest numbers were not as large as had been expected.
Rick Pearson, chief political writer for the Chicago Tribune. Again, the big surprise announcement from President Obama today at the NATO summit that he feels Afghan forces will take over the country's defenses in 2013, a full year ahead of what had been announced as a schedule. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
We want to switch gears now to spend a few minutes today on one aspect of what's being called the do-it-yourself movement in medicine. People with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, who say they don't have time to wait for an FDA-approved cure, are cooking up drug therapies on their own and sharing that information online. ALS affects about 30,000 Americans. It causes cell damage in the brain and spinal cord. It gradually robs people of the ability to move or even breathe. It's insidious. The average life expectancy is 2 to 5 years after diagnosis. Amy Marcus of The Wall Street Journal recently wrote about this do-it-yourself movement in the ALS community. Amy, we spoke with ALS sufferer Corey Reach a while back, and he told us his biggest frustration is that companies either don't want to invest in an ALS drug trial because of the short lifespan of patients, or when companies do have trials, he can't qualify. You heard that, too. Many patients not qualifying for trials because they're too far along in their disease.
And then for other people who do qualify for the trials, it takes a long time to get the results. And many of them get frustrated because they need something urgently right now.
Time is something they don't have. So they are, you know, making their own. Now, this isn't something that where they're just whipping up something on their own in their kitchens. They are looking at a trial that's being run by Neuraltis Pharmaceuticals in Palo Alto, California. Tell us about this.
Many of these patients follow ALS news very, very carefully. They watch for press releases by companies who have compounds that are coming out. In this case, they saw a press release issued by this company that there was going to be a drug trial, and they set out to do research to figure out what exactly the compound was. They looked at documents that they could get their hands on. They went to webinars that the company CEO gave. They shared data online with each other, including patients who ultimately enrolled in the trial. And they came to the conclusion that it was a particular compound that they could get their hands on in a raw form.
Neuraltis Pharmaceuticals is calling the compound they're running a trial on NP001.
Correct. So no one knows exactly what's in it because they've obviously done some work to it. But after their research, they came to the conclusion that a large component of it was likely sodium chloride, which is a compound that's used in a number of different ways in different forms, including in municipal water sewage systems, including as bleach. And it's available online.
And you found ALS patients who have obtained it and are injecting themselves?
Some patients are drinking it. They're mixing it with water and trying to drink it. And other people are having it injected.
Look, people have commented on this. ALS Therapy Development Institute here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is the only company that's focused exclusively, solely on finding a cure for ALS, was quoted in your story as saying people have the right to do whatever they want. However, maybe they should be doing it with doctors and researchers. Is there a concern about just taking this, what is it called again? This
sodium chloride.
Sodium chloride, just drinking it or injecting it?
Well, of course there's a concern because no one knows for certain what changes the company has made to the compound. No one knows how it's being made in the places that they're buying it, whether they're mixing it in a way or infusing it in a way that's sterile and good for them. So, of course, there's concern. The patients argue that they're taking precautions, that they're doing their research, that they're taking doses that are lower than doses that are being used in the trial, that they're monitoring themselves. But of course, there's always a potential that they're going to harm themselves and potentially accelerate their disease.
On the other hand, what have the patients who have injected themselves with sodium chloride said to you? Do any of them feel that there's an improvement?
Yes. One of the people I interviewed said that he noticed an improvement in swallowing, and that's a very important change in terms of quality of life. Of course, he can't be certain it's tied to the drug. The disease goes up and down. People have good days and bad days. So that's sort of the dilemma that the patients themselves face. They're collecting data as well as they can. They hope to analyze it, and they hope to discuss it in a kind of public way with doctors, clinicians, other patients. But no one can be sure if it's having a beneficial effect, just as no one in a drug trial can be sure if something's having a beneficial effect until they unblind it and do the analysis.
Right, because you're not even sure in a drug trial if you've got the drug or the placebo.
You don't know. Yeah. And the whole point of a drug trial, the whole driving question behind a drug trial is they're telling you, we don't know for sure whether this is going to have a beneficial effect. And that's why we're running a drug trial. We need to test that idea.
Well, you spoke to ALS sufferers who started websites and are collecting some of this information. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, one of them started a website where he's trying specifically to collect data on patients who are taking sodium chloride. But there's a website that's already been established that's part of a company called Patients Like Me that has a huge number of ALS patients who share data online, all kinds of data, not just about sodium chloride.
And Eric Valor is the ALS patient who has started his own website to collect data on the use of sodium chloride. What does he say? I mean, I'm just so struck by the time element here. Somebody has only 4, 5, 6 years and they're starting a website and they're trying to collect data and they're injecting themselves and they're doing all of this with the clock ticking.
Yeah, the clock is ticking for patients. And I think that everyone recognizes that ALS is a lethal disease, that it can have a very rapid course. Eric, in our exchange, and he wasn't able to speak with me, we had to conduct our interview via email. He's on a ventilator. He did write to me and say, every day is precious to me. I don't want to do something that will take even one day away from myself. I am not trying to harm myself. What I'm trying to do is buy time in the hopes that there will be drugs that come onto the market and are developed that will help him stay alive.
What is the sense in the medical community about the ethics of this? I mean, is there a thinking that this is such a unique community of patients because of the time element that, I don't know, maybe it's, a little bit more okay that they have this ad hoc research set up than it would be for other communities?
I think the doctors that I spoke with, they weren't critical of the patients because they understand what's driving the patient's desire to do this. But they're concerned that the patients not harm themselves. And I think their preference would be that there needs to be some new way of collecting data so that no one's hurting themselves and also that the data that they are generating isn't lost and is collected in the most rigorous manner possible so that other patients may benefit.
Sort of a set of more formalized and regulated ad hoc trials running alongside the company's research trials.
It's going to require some outside-the-box thinking. But now that do-it-yourself science is here to stay, now that people are able to organize on the internet,
Sure. Set
up websites, collect data, the doctors I spoke to says that it would make sense to try to think outside the box, you know, with ways of collecting this data and ultimately using it to benefit drug research and patients' health.
That's Amy Marcus of The Wall Street Journal. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to our look at how people with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, have taken to brewing their own drugs rather than waiting for clinical trials. Ben Harris is a 45-year-old medical physicist from Bloomington, Indiana, who was diagnosed with ALS last year. He took part in the drug company Neuraltis's clinical trial for NP001. It's based on sodium chloride. When that trial ended, Ben joined other ALS patients who are injecting themselves with the compound. Now, Ben has trouble speaking, and so our producer, Kevin Sullivan, spent an afternoon talking with him online. We've asked our colleague, Steph Katsonitz, to read back with Kevin the transcript of what ended up being two guys, one with a fatal illness, shooting the breeze.
Can you start by describing what your condition's like now? For example, you can obviously type, but what are your physical limitations?
At this point, I'm at the tail end of being able to communicate verbally and being able to eat. I'd say in a few months I won't be able to utter a word, and I'll need to have a feeding tube placed. All my muscles are affected. Walking is slow, and climbing stairs is getting a little challenging. I have to exercise caution. One might not even be able to tell by observing me that there's anything wrong in those areas other than speech, but it takes a great deal of effort to appear normal.
After the Neuraltis clinical trial for NP001 ended, you started taking sodium chloride on your own, injecting yourself with it. Are you still doing that, and do you think it's been effective?
Yeah, I am still doing the injections. Although the positive effect of sodium chloride did begin to wear off near the end of the NP001 trial, and it seems to have little effect now, other than a possible slowing of my disease, I did have one hint that it may still be helping. About 1 month ago, after one of my self-infusions, my swallowing improved, just as it had done in the beginning of the study. That lasted for about 1 week and then faded. I was just about to give up on it, but this event has made me even more determined to stick with it as long as I am able.
Do you think there's a possibility you could be chasing ghosts by taking the sodium chloride, maybe hoping for something that might not even be there?
Certainly. However, sodium chloride is different from any other substance tested for ALS, either formally or informally, in that it has actually improved the status of those who took it, if only temporarily. Nothing has ever done that.
You're sharing the results of taking sodium chloride by taking part in an ad hoc study, where you share your information on a website called Patients Like Me. How do you hope that information is going to be used? And do you feel that the analysis could end up helping you?
I understand that the likelihood of one of these ad hoc studies leading to a significant discovery is low. But that's only half the point. It is a horrible feeling thinking about the hundreds of substances out there and wondering whether one of them helps, but you are missing out. My hope is that the information will ultimately be analyzed by the mathematicians at Patients Like Me. It will be admittedly noisy data, but mathematical algorithms have become sophisticated to the point that they can filter out much of this noise. I do hope that I hit pay dirt with one of these trials, but the chance of this happening is unlikely. However, my actions today may help the 44-year-old male with a wonderful family and nothing but good things to look forward to who gets this diagnosis next year or next decade.
But, you know, when the Wall Street Journal reported on this do-it-yourself movement to treat ALS, they spoke to doctors and researchers who said, one concern is that no one really knows for certain what changes Neurolytus, that's the company doing the NP001 clinical trial, what changes they've made to the sodium chloride. So you might not even be taking the same thing that's being administered under the clinical trial.
These are very valid concerns, but what makes this kind of statement difficult to listen to without eliciting a strong negative reaction from me is that none of these doctors or researchers has taken the time to read our discussion threads or join the conversation. If they had, they would understand that although Neuraltis has not publicly stated what is in NP001, we have figured it out. And if any of these doctors or researchers would take the time to read the discussion forums and follow the paper trail that we have uncovered, they would agree. The offhand skeptical remark that we don't know what NP001 is made out of sheer laziness. What is equally offensive is the implication that because we are mere patients, we are incapable of understanding the science or biology surrounding this or any drug. We are a group of extremely well-educated, careful, and determined people who have collectively spent thousands of hours poring over academic journals and patent applications.
Well, what about your family? How do they feel about you trying these treatments on your own? Or do they trust you because you're a medical physicist and you have an area of expertise that other people with ALS don't?
I think my background does help immensely. I understand the science behind these things, I understand the mathematics of the chances, and I am not blinded by hope. As for my wife, she trusts me and pretty much leaves the decision on what to try up to me. She sees me spending literally hundreds of hours researching these things and knows that unless I felt they were safe, I wouldn't do them. From the outside, it seems like a reckless endeavor, but on the contrary, these are very well-educated guesses. I have a son who's 7, and he's completely unaware of what I'm trying.
Well, that makes me think. You say you spend literally hundreds of hours researching these things and doing work on this. And I wonder, how much longer do you plan on doing this? Because it sounds like you're spending a lot of time and energy researching and working on treatments. But are you maybe giving up something else on the other end, like the limited time that you have with your family?
That's a great question. Actually, the instant I was diagnosed, I changed my lifestyle to spend more time with my family. Prior to my diagnosis, I traveled extensively for my job, spending as much as a month on the road at a time. I missed the majority of my son's childhood from age 2 to 5, some of the most precious years of his childhood. That I did merely to earn a paycheck, not to save my life. I'm still working full-time, but I no longer travel, and as soon as the clock strikes 5, I close my laptop and stop working and put work out of my mind. I devote every minute of the evening to my wife and son. I'm a night owl, so as soon as they go to bed, I dive into the DIY research again. I plan to do this until I'm no longer physically able to take care of myself. When I reach the point where I can no longer walk or move my hands, it's pretty much game over.
Ben, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us, and take care and the best of luck to you and your family.
Thank you.
Next week in The Hague, Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, will be sentenced for war crimes. Last month, Taylor was found guilty of aiding and abetting murder, rape, and terrorism, and forcing the enlistment of child soldiers in a civil war in neighboring Sierra Leone. Taylor supplied the rebels in Sierra Leone with arms and ammunition in exchange for so-called blood diamonds from Sierra Leone's mines. Well, today, diamond mining in Sierra Leone is clean, not adding to the spoils of war. And it's a major industry in that country, as the BBC's Mark Doyle reports.
Listen to the sound of peace in today's Sierra Leone. But the war did finish here a decade ago. This wasn't a bomb, but a controlled detonation in a new, modern diamond mine in the east of the country. Industrial machines crawling around a huge quarry collecting diamond-bearing rock. It's a completely different scene to what I saw back in the 1990s. Then this rebel-held area was a moonscape of small, hand-dug pits where rebels press-ganged locals into digging and panning for diamonds that they then traded to buy arms. The judges at the International Court said Charles Taylor profited from these blood diamonds. The war ended after British troops intervened in Sierra Leone against the rebels in the year 2000. Two democratic elections later, and this West African state, rich in diamonds, iron ore, and other precious metals, is seeing what could be the beginning of an economic boom. It's not just the new mines. Roads are being laid across the country, and there are buildings going up everywhere. At the airport in the capital, Freetown, I spot an unfamiliar jet parked on the apron. It turns out to belong to one of the world's richest men, visiting what is, still, one of the world's poorest countries. He's Benny Steinmetz, an Israeli billionaire and the owner of the new diamond mine. But the question is, will it bring prosperity to the country as a whole? In the river valleys surrounding Benny Steinmetz's new industrial mine, thousands of Sierra Leoneans are still engaged in the back-breaking work of digging and panning for diamonds by hand. They eke out a precarious living, much like they did before. The face of Sierra Leone has undoubtedly changed for the better, much better, with peace. But the new mining investments are just small islands of prosperity in a still very poor country. In the town of Koidu, near the new mine, I didn't see a single properly tarmacked road. The traders in the market were dynamic enough, but many can't even afford tables to display their goods. The mayor of the town, Sir Musa Sesig Benda, nevertheless says things are on the mend.
Before the war, when I was here, the economy was vibrant. And during the war, then the economy just, you know, took a nosedive. Now, as you see, people are trying to rebuild the economy. We are trying to rebuild the economy.
The vast majority of people in Sierra Leone, like these cocoa traders meeting in a small warehouse, live off the land. And the chairman of the local cocoa buyers association, Job Kwademba, says that to bring large numbers of people out of poverty, Sierra Leone will have to make finance available to pay for seeds, tools and farm labour.
They have land, but if you don't have money to cultivate that land, it's very difficult. You can't just go and cultivate 20, 30 acres on your own. You need assistance, and financial assistance or any other thing is not available.
The jury is still out on whether the big new mines will change the lives of the majority of poor Sierra Leoneans. It's not yet clear how much of the big investment money will, as economists say, trickle down to the people. But peace is better than war, and clean diamonds are better than blood diamonds.
The BBC's Mark Doyle in Sierra Leone. In the trial in Philadelphia of the first U.S. Roman Catholic Church official charged with covering up child sex abuse by priests, the question is whether Monsignor William Lynn of Philadelphia will take the stand in his own defense. His lawyers will start arguing tomorrow that Lynn, the former secretary of the clergy, whose job it was to police wayward priests, was a middle manager, unfairly held accountable for higher-ups' failures to remove priests. In 8 weeks of testimony so far, district attorneys have shown jurors nearly 2,000 documents, including a recently found church file listing the names of abusive priests. A parade of now middle-aged former altar boys has taken the stand to describe how priests abused them. And the trial comes as the archdiocese has been removing priests for molesting children. John Martin has been covering the trial for the Philadelphia Inquirer. John, there were other priests charged in this scandal. Two are awaiting separate trials. One pled guilty. One's a co-defendant with Lynn. His name is James Brennan. What exactly is Monsignor Lynn charged with? What is the priest Brennan charged with? And why were they on trial together?
Well, both Lynn and Brennan are priests of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Monsignor Lynn, as Secretary of Clergy, what he's accused of, basically, is making assignments, assigning priests such as Brennan to parishes, despite either knowing or seeing signs that they may have been abusive. So Lynn is actually charged with endangerment, endangering children by putting priests in positions that gave them access to children. Brennan is accused of an actual charge of abuse. He's actually charged with trying to rape a 14-year-old boy back in 1996.
And Brennan and Lynn were charged originally with conspiring, but a judge made a ruling on that on Thursday. Tell us about that.
Right. What the judge decided after hearing the prosecution case was that the prosecution had not met its burden in terms of proving that there was a conspiracy between Lynn and Brennan, that they actually acted in concert to put him in that position to endanger children. But the jury still gets to decide whether or not Lynn actually did endanger children by putting Brennan in that position.
Well, the evidence that's been used in the trial was part of a nearly 500-page grand jury report from way back in 2005. This was after the priest abuse scandal in Boston had already broken. So why didn't that grand jury report lead to a trial then in Philadelphia?
And there's a lot of debate about that. But what ultimately was the decision by the district attorney at the time and the decision of the grand jury was that although they found lots of evidence of priests who had sexually abused children, all of those cases were so far beyond the statute of limitations that they couldn't be prosecuted. And so what's happened since then, in the wake of that grand jury report, and one of its recommendations were that there were to be amendments to the statute of limitations. Now, not far enough, some would say, but it did extend it to a certain extent that allowed these charges to be brought this time.
Okay. Well, and so now these victims are testifying, and it's been searing. We're hearing from now middle-aged men who claim they were abused on camping and sporting trips with their priests. You write, telling their stories like it happened yesterday. And then there was also this list of abusive priests, a file the church originally said they couldn't find. Then they did. What's in that?
Yeah, and this is what prosecutors have portrayed this as a smoking gun of sorts. And this was something that back in the early 90s, when Monsignor Lynn first became Secretary of Clergy, and he was a top aide to Cardinal Anthony Bevilacqua, he compiled this list. He went through all the secret files, the secret archives, as they're actually described, which are the files that include all the allegations and details of abuse complaints against priests. And he compiled this list. And there were three aspects to the list. The first part of the list named priests who had been diagnosed as pedophiles. The second part of the list named priests who were guilty of sexual misconduct with minors, and nine times out of ten, that meant that they had been accused and had admitted it. And the third portion of the list identified priests who were suspected or had been accused, but for whom there was no conclusive evidence. So here they had a list of about three dozen priests. Now, Lynn had never denied that he made this list, but nobody could ever find it. Suddenly, it emerged only this year. It was turned over by church lawyers. They said it had been locked in a safe that nobody knew about for a dozen years, and then it was stuffed in a file drawer. And it's a real mysterious thing. And I'll tell you, the significance of that list is this, that the first name on the page that lists priests guilty of sexual misconduct with minors is Edward Avery, and that is one of Lynn's co-defendants in this case. That's the man who pleaded guilty already. The reason that's significant is if Monsignor Lynn knew in 1994 that Edward Avery was already guilty of sexual misconduct with minors, and what prosecutors say is then he let Avery still live at a parish, and in 1999, Avery pleaded guilty to the fact that in 1999 he actually sexually assaulted an altar boy at that parish.
Well, and as we said, Monsignor Lynn's lawyers are saying that he's being held accountable for higher-ups failing to remove abusive priests, you know, sort of implying that he may have wanted to, but others wouldn't let him. You mentioned Cardinal Bevilacqua. He's since died, so he of course, can't be brought to trial. So what is the defense that Monsignor Lynn is expected to present this week?
Well, they have maintained all along that if you look at his recommendations for any time an allegation came forward, he always recommended removing the priests, getting them treatment, and then putting them in some sort of limited ministry. And they claim that, and you can look at the files, I mean, he did make recommendations, but ultimately decisions were made by Bevilacqua. So they're going to claim and have claimed that Monsignor Lynn did everything he could possibly do, given one of the ugliest jobs in the entire archdiocese.
Well, meanwhile, this is happening as we heard this month that the church is removing five priests after the church investigation of 26 priests that were mentioned in last year's grand jury investigation. Now, this demonstrates that the church is investigating itself, but, you know, raise questions for us. You know, is law enforcement involved in this?
And law enforcement still is involved for this. Law enforcement's supposed to get the first call when a complaint comes into the church through its victim's line. One of the first things they're supposed to do is turn around and call law enforcement and let prosecutors and detectives look at the evidence and decide if, in fact, it falls within the statute of limitations. Most of the time, it does not. So in those cases this month, those were all old cases that could not be prosecuted. But there are at least a half dozen cases that are being examined right now by local district attorneys and detectives.
Well, we're reading an article by the editor-at-large of the National Catholic Reporter who says that the Philadelphia Archdiocese is considered one of the most insular in the country. Is there a sense now with these priest removals that we're seeing that things are changing under the new archbishop? This is Charles Chaput.
Well, Chaput's been here for about 6 months, and he's got a long laundry list of things to do with this archdiocese. So I'm not sure that anyone is in a position yet to say if things are changing, how they are changing, and in what direction.
Ms. John Martin, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. John, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
In a minute, we'll have a goodbye to a music giant. But first, meet an up-and-comer, Jamie Woon. That's Jamie Woon's Night Air. It was a big deal in his native England. Now it's being released in the U.S. along with his debut album, Mirror Writing. He's the son of the famous Celtic singer Mae McKenna and cites everyone from Radiohead to Boys to Men as influences. The indie website Pitchfork says his album sits between club culture, old school soul, and modern electronic R&B. So there. 28-year-old Jamie Woon joins us from the BBC studios in London. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Here are some other descriptions. The BBC, where you are, calls your music electro-soul. Pitchfork says you blur musical worlds. Everybody trying to describe it. How would you describe your music?
I would probably say it was an R&B record.
R&B. Well, let's listen actually to a cut that we feel we hear a little of that in. TMRW. By the way, what does that stand for?
Tomorrow.
Oh, hello.
Tech speak. Yeah.
Let's listen to a little. If you can, for the sake of peace, how do we get through tomorrow every day? I don't know, but we get through it anyway. Another day comes round. What influences am I hearing as you sing there?
I'm a huge Stevie Wonder fan. His songwriting, his rhythm, his, you know, the message behind his songs. I think he's quite naked with his emotions in his songs, but he makes them so accessible as well, so funky. Yeah.
Who were your other influences?
Jeff Buckley, John Martin, Peter Gabriel, Lewis Taylor.
Well, and how about your mom, Celtic folk singer Mae McKenna? Actually, let's listen to a little of her.
And I walk in the footsteps of my father, and I ran in the shadow of his dreams, and I live.
Mae McKenna singing Footsteps of My Father, but she also sang backup for Michael Jackson, Kylie Minogue. It sounds as if through your mom, either through her own music or just the world she traveled in, you might have picked up a thing or two.
Oh, definitely. I mean, she's the number one influence in so many ways. But yeah, she sort of had this sort of double life as a folk singer and as a session singer doing pop records and commercials. So I was, you know, exposed to those communities of music musicians growing up, and her making her music as well. She produced 3 albums when I was younger.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to some more of your music and then ask you how you get to it. Here's Echoes. Jamie Woon, I'm also hearing a little Laurie Anderson here, but which comes first, sort of a sense of sound or a story you want to tell?
Yeah, the songs come first, and the songs and the groove, that's all there when I write the song. And then what I really got excited about with production was just atmosphere and injecting it with different samples and sounds.
Let's listen to Spirits, a little bit of Spirits first, and then ask you about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, surely
is that you on vocals?
Yeah, I just stack tons of them up, and then you change the format a little bit on the sound, so it sort of sounds lower, but without pitching it lower.
What's it like? We know that you went to the London School for Performing Arts and Technology. This is the school they call the Brit School. A year behind Amy Winehouse, who's now gone. And I think, did Adele go to that school as well?
Yes.
Yeah. What's going on? What's going on in the water there in Britain? You know, these great voices coming out of this school.
I've got really fond memories of the school. You know, it was, you know, there was just a lot going on. You know, they had sort of a concert in the foyer every Thursday afternoon. You know, they put a PA system in the foyer, basically, but it was a big open space, and the music students could sign up and sing a song, and it could be something you'd written or some, you know, ridiculous thing.
How nice. How fun. And now you've apparently written several things that are catapulting you. What do you think happens next?
Well, I'm kind of thinking about my next album now. I'm first record. It's the classic cliche. It was 10 years in the making, and I'm just excited to move on to a new batch of songs.
Well, and will it be the new sound, or it will be one that you seem to have had before, because there's some YouTube videos floating around of you playing guitar. Let's listen to one. This is called Missing Person.
Could have let you know I'd gone. You might have thought you'd done something wrong. Well, I can tell you why I've been setting fire to the wires that entangle the world.
So, you know, is that the sound that you had to make because you didn't have access to all the synthesized sounds, or is that, you know, a sound you could easily go back to?
It's more the other way around, actually, because I couldn't record any acoustic instruments very well. So I think, you know, it's kind of, You can. It's a bit more gratifying with electronic sounds. You can make it sound fatter with less effort.
And so that's going to be your sound.
I think I've certainly got more resources than I had when I started. You know, I've got a smaller studio in my house. So I'm just playing around with that. But yeah, I've always been interested in this sort of in where the places where electronic and acoustic sounds meet. You know, I think it's just about the songs for me, really.
Yeah. British singer-songwriter Jamie Woon. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
One last note. There was so much more to the Bee Gees than Night Fever or Stayin' Alive, hits from 1977's Saturday Night Fever. You've heard, I'm sure, B.G. Robin Gibb died of cancer. His death got us thinking about everything else in the B.G. jukebox.
Have you seen my wife?
Mr. Jones. Do you know what it's like on the outside? Baby, you don't know what it's like to love somebody, to love somebody the way I love you.
Some of the other hits the Bee Gees wrote: If I Can't Have You for Yvonne Elliman, Heartbreaker for Dionne Warwick, Emotion for Destiny's Child. British DJ Paul Gambaccini writes today that the Bee Gees are second only to Lennon and McCartney in British popular music. Or as we just said, they were so much more than Saturday Night Fever. Try not to sing along.
How can you stop the rain from falling down?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what this week brings here and now.
Ever win.